Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and phone calls. And I'll be giving out those numbers in just a moment. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I had to share this statistic with you. I came across this in preparing for the show, and this is astonishing. Currently, up to 40% of CT scans are ordered unnecessarily. That is to say, when they're looked at critically, they are redundant. There is another way to find the information. The information already exists in the chart. Or it's really done to reassure the doctors, or possibly the patient, rather than for any real clinical. Well, the way we put it in medicine is, do I order a test if the answer is not going to change my management? And the answer to that should be, no, I don't. Especially when we're talking about CT scans. The expense aside, a single CT scan of the abdomen has a typical effective radiation dose of 10 millisieverts. Now, that, my friends, is 3 1/3 years of natural background radiation. Let me say that again. 3 1/3 years of natural background radiation. In other words, the level of radiation that our bodies are evolutionarily adapted to handle. And we're throwing that at you. Well, it's great. I mean, if you may have appendicitis and we can't figure it out and we're trying to decide whether to cut you open or not, yeah, probably you want the CT scan. But if we pretty much know you've got appendicitis, maybe we should skip the CT scan and just take out your appendix. The standard of care in medicine has gotten ahead of the standard of good common sense, and we are no longer doing CT scans for the right reasons. So when you are told you need an abdominal CT or you need a head CT, maybe what you want to do is ask the doctor, really? Is there another way? Is there another imaging test that might give us enough information so that I could avoid the radiation? Doctor, I'm nervous about the radiation. What about that 3 years of natural background radiation figure I heard? Is that true? Your doctor probably doesn't even know that. That's the sad thing. So we need to push back a little bit on the CT scans. Just precautionary principle here, folks. The other thing that I wanted to talk to you about is a follow-up on Ebola. One of the people who survived catching Ebola was Dr. Ian Crozier. He was released back in October from Emory University Hospital. He almost died. He was one of those sick people that you saw being brought in by CNN, sort of shepherded by people in full biohazard suits. Well, he's certified Ebola-free, but Dr. Crozier, who's 44, was recently found not to be Ebola-free. Here's the story. He showed up a couple of months ago with some eye trouble. He was noticing he was having trouble seeing out of his eye, and he developed pain in his eye, blurred vision. And when he was seen in the ophthalmology office recently, they thought, well, maybe he has inflammation of the iris. This is called uveitis. Let's see if there's some sort of inflammatory substance or another infection in his eyeball. So they drew a small amount of fluid from the inside of the eyeball, and even though Dr. Crozier does not have any Ebola in his bloodstream, his eyeball was chock full of Ebola, and the Ebola was causing an immune reaction called uveitis. They've been treating him with an experimental new non-FDA approved antiviral agent, which they had to get special permission to use, and it's working. He's probably going to keep his sight. But if you go and look at what's being reported in the aftermath of the Ebola infection in Africa, a great many people are complaining of persistent inflammation, about blurred vision, eyeball pain, hearing loss, and body aches. This chronic pain syndrome, deep fatigue, deep joint and muscle pain, this is looking to me as a functional medicine doctor like chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which is another way of thinking about chronic fatigue syndrome, that the immune system is upregulated, that it's stuck on high and is churning out too many antibodies, upregulating too many T cells, going on a search and destroy mission, and effectively making the person chronically ill as the aftermath of being turned on by a severe infection. And we do not know how to turn this off. A brief comment on the subject of Alzheimer's disease. This just in from the Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry. Regular listeners to this program will remember I've discussed autophagy and this concept that we build up in our cells protein aggregates that then get in the way of normal cellular functioning. This concept of protein aggregation as a aging mechanism is very important and is the focus of a great deal of research, because if we're going to achieve a meaningful lengthening of the human lifespan, we need to understand why cells break down, how they break down, and how to reverse it. Results recently published from the research teams of Drs. Hartle and Mann at the Max Planck Institute, this was published in the journal Cell, showed that there's a sea change, a phase change that occurs as cells age. And the accumulation of these aggregates can go in two directions. They can either remain as soluble aggregates that float around and tangle up the normal functioning in the cytosol of the cell, or longer-lived mutations. They're using a nematode called Caenorhabditis elegans, or C. elegans, and looking at short-lived and long-lived variants of this particular nematode. And they found that the longer living worms, the ones that live the longest, actually take their own protein aggregates, which still form at the same rate, and they cover them with something called chaperone proteins and turn them into an insoluble lump, essentially coagulating them or solidifying them. And then these can literally be shoved against the wall or swept under the carpet, for which is my own housekeeping metaphor, to keep the hallways clear so that the business of staying alive and producing proteins and digesting food and distributing energy, all of the important things that a cell does, well, those can continue unimpeded because the hallways are cleared. The closets might be full, but the hallways are cleared. And again, that sort of relates to my own personal housekeeping metaphor. We're going to go now to our first caller, and that is Pat in Carmel. Hello, Pat. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I just want to thank you so much for the service you do for the community. My question this morning is, I'm having neck pain, and I have what feels like a bulging disc in my vertebra in my neck. And I'd just like to know your advice, or get your advice on how to proceed with finding out about it. It's hard to know where to begin.
Okay, well, let me start by asking you, when you say it feels like a bulging disc, I have no idea what you mean by that.
Okay, well, there's one of the vertebrae, right, right at the top of my neck, mm-hmm. sticks out, and I can push on it. Mm-hmm. And that may be normal, I don't know.
Well, if you would anyway. Not be able to feel a bulging disc. It's okay, it's then, much, much deeper. Realistically, 2 to 3 inches in from your skin. is the place where the disc bulges. So it's really not going to be something you can palpate. But people can develop loose ligaments in their neck. And this is called subluxation. This is the sort of thing that chiropractors talk about. And, you know, chiropractors and doctors have this sort of ingrained Hatfields and McCoy thing that we're taught in medical school to have. But it's interesting, that kind of training socialization. I have to say I've seen it in some of my acupuncture colleagues, because I'm an MD, and that's acupuncturists. Some of them are trained to think about MDs the way that doctors are trained to think about chiropractors. And this is all garbage, by the way. There are great clinicians in all fields. But you get into this us versus them mentality, and if you're not careful, you can become prejudiced. Back to you. So I know a little bit about chiropractic, and I have a great respect for my chiropractic colleagues for their ability to feel things, and osteopaths as well. They learn to train their fingers in ways that allow them to actually feel the alignment of the vertebrae. And I have a hard time feeling the alignment of vertebrae, but even I've felt subluxations. Sometimes people will just displace something. Sometimes you can have muscle spasm. Sometimes you could have a subcutaneous lump. So what you're feeling might be a lot of things, but what I could say pretty clearly is you're not feeling that bulging disc with your fingers.
Okay, so it could be a ligament.
It could be that your bone is loose and is kind of backing, and then that puts a stretch on things, and that'll hurt. If you had a bulging disc, you would probably know it because you would have pain or numbness in your arm or hand. And if you don't have that, then it's not a surgical lesion, and you probably don't need an x-ray or a CT scan, since picking up back on the opening topic of whether one needs a CT or an MRI even of something like this.
Right.
You probably don't. You have pain, and you should be evaluated for that. But as long as there's no loss of dexterity or numbness or pain in your arms or fingers, this is not something that would require the services of a neurosurgeon. Neck pain is incredibly common. Usually where I start out is body work, maybe some acupuncture. I do one does a clinical evaluation to assess the reflexes and the dexterity to make sure things are fine and that there are no red flags. And then you move to, okay, well, if it's a displaced vertebrae because of loose ligaments, then you're first of all going to want to put that back in place. And then you're secondly going to want to strengthen the muscles so that the muscles will do the job that the ligament is no longer able to do. So essentially, rehabilitation, physical therapy exercises, probably a muscles and core strengthening program would be where you go after you get the immediate pain under control.
So would that be beginning with a chiropractor and going to a physical therapist, or starting with
Do you have a primary care doctor?
I do.
Well, start with getting checked out by your primary care doctor and get that person's opinion, and also have your reflexes and things checked. That's what we're trained to do. And then, I think as long as you don't have any red flag symptoms, going to chiropractor, osteopath, or asking for a referral to physical therapy if you're uncomfortable with the concept of having your neck manipulated. And I personally find it, people will probably be surprised that I find it difficult to give up control and let somebody move my head around. So for some of us, that's actually quite challenging. And I do better with massage and acupuncture for my neck issues, which have been, go back to college, because guess what? I carried a heavy book bag on one shoulder for 4 years and I screwed up my neck. And this sort of thing probably stretched out some ligaments on that side. It goes out of alignment, but I don't do well with being realigned forcefully. So I kind of have to get everything to relax, and then it pops back into place.
Okay. All right. I will give that a shot. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going now to Valerie in San Juan Bautista. Hello, Valerie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Oh, we've got rain. This is wonderful.
It is.
And outside of that, let's see, about 2 months ago, I was in Hawaii with my grandsons and body surfing. My grandson came from the side and ripped into my knee from the side. And I've been, I iced it and put warm and ice and lots of ibuprofen. My doctor gave me Celebrex.
Mm-hmm.
I tried that for a few days, and I didn't like how I felt with it, so I went back to the ibuprofen.
That's
but what
fine.
I'm wondering now, I hate having a pain, and I keep working past it and doing stuff. I live out in the country, and so I'm wondering, how long am I going to nurse this knee? It seems to be, it's not, I don't have a sharp pain, like, inside the knee. It's like the muscle on the inside, down below that bump on your knee.
All right, so the big toe side of the knee.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the medial aspect of the knee, rather than lateral. And so if he came in from the side, did he hit you on the outside part of the leg?
Yes.
Yeah, but it bent you in such a way that you were having symptoms on the inside part of the
yes.
knee. So that's quite interesting. Any history of prior injury on that knee? Did you ever
no.
blow anything out, tear a meniscus,
no.
or have any major swelling? Okay.
Nothing.
So the next question is the squatting and going downstairs question. So when you go downstairs, does this trigger the pain?
Yeah, I'm very careful going downstairs, right? I feel pain.
You feel pain in that location on the inside part of your
uh-huh,
knee?
Uh-huh, yes.
Okay. So I think what he did was I think he swatted your kneecap. That's a kneecap symptom. When you,
uh-huh.
when the pain is worse when you're going into or out of a squat or especially lowering yourself downstairs, that's when it'll be at its worst. That's kneecap because when your quads tighten, they drag your kneecap across the there's basically a little track that the kneecap is supposed to sit in, but the kneecap can get flipped laterally, and then it can bruise or even tear the cartilage. So then when you're dragging, you know, it's like dragging, wearing a shoe that gave you the blister 2 days ago, and you put the shoe back on, and it's like, oh, my God, because the blister is now raw and sore, and so even just putting that shoe on your foot hurts. So kneecap test. For this is go down to the drugstore and pick yourself up one of these little sleeves. They're made of wetsuit fabric, neoprene.
I'm using that.
And mm-hmm. does it help?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So again, suggesting, so that's confirmatory for kneecap. So there's, you can go online and you can look up something called Muncie exercises, like Muncie, Indiana.
Yeah.
And there are a series of kneecap exercises. I'd probably go to YouTube and watch a couple of people doing it and kind of take uh-huh. the average. You kind of watch three or four people doing the same exercise, and then there will be agreement. Say three out of the four will do it the same way. That's the way you want to be doing it.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? Because yeah. If you just look at one, you might pick up someone who's doing it incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. Just can you kind of go with the consensus on these things if you're going to use the internet, or you could go to a physical therapist and be trained in these. But essentially, it's a special kind of knee extension that builds up the medial quad, which is the vastus medialis. This muscle tends to get loose and floppy. It's the one in women that has to do all the heavy lifting because we have a wide hip base and a narrow knee base. Men's legs kind of go straight up and down, but women's go in, and that's called a Q angle, but it puts a lot of strain on the medial knee, the big toe side of the knee. And the kneecap itself keeps getting yanked. So if you jam the kneecap, which he may have done, it sounds like that's a strong possibility. You have a stable knee. The red flags for a knee that would mean that maybe you actually have something wrong with the meniscus and you may need more aggressive medical management, physical therapy, would be if you have locking or collapse. So you're walking along and suddenly your leg doesn't straighten out. It just click. It just holds itself. Or you're walking along and everything's fine, and then suddenly you have a collapse where you just kind of lose the support on that leg.
Those, not so far, thank you.
Yeah, those two things, those are orthopedic surgery red flags for something going on in the knee that actually needs surgical attention. But the chances are that this is kneecap, especially since you're getting improvement with just that little neoprene sleeve. So I would say Muncie exercises, ice, yeah, go ahead and maybe ask for a patellar sunrise view, which it's an x-ray that it's called the sunrise view of the kneecap. And it basically looks at the cartilage on either side, sees if it's uneven, because you may have had uneven wear here for years, not aware of it, and that little swat just kind of cracked the egg, and now you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, you're going to do more extensive rehab, and you may be dealing with a painful knee when you do a lot of hiking, and you take some anti-inflammatories, you throw some ice on it, you know, do daily megadose fish oil and maybe some turmeric just to manage symptoms. By the way, when I say megadose fish oil, I'm talking about 4,000 milligrams of fish oil or 2,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA. And that's good for you for a lot of reasons, but that's you're not going to get that with eating fish. That's a supplement level dose. But it is a good anti-inflammatory, very helpful for pain.
Can you spell Muncie?
M-U-N-C-I-E.
M-U-N-C-I-E. Okay. I'll check it online. Muncie exercise.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A little bit about these new oral anticoagulants. This has been cropping up in my medical practice for about the last 3 years. And let me give you some background. We use, as you probably know, a compound called coumarin, warfarin, or coumadin, most commonly called. This substance is a blood thinner. It's actually a toxin. If you give massive quantities to rats, you will kill them, and it is used as a rat poison. It is a compound that interferes with a part of the coagulation cascade, and it can be reversed with massive doses of vitamin K. But it's got what we call a narrow therapeutic window, which means that too much and you'll bleed out. You'll start hemorrhaging. Not enough, and whatever your blood clotting issue is, whether it's a history of phlebitis or a tendency to clot or atrial fibrillation, and you're not containing that risk. And the problem with coumadin is that it interacts with a lot of other drugs. So many antibiotics, for example, lots of other drugs, antifungals, things that you might commonly be given will really throw off the way your body handles this drug, causing you to have a relative overdose or a relative underdose. And because it's related to vitamin K, if you eat a lot of vitamin K in your diet, you're going to reverse the drug. So people have to follow a restricted diet. And we've learned that we pretty much have to check them once a month. This is cumbersome. So when these new factor 10A inhibitors came out a few years ago, there was a great avidity to switch to them. And the recommendations for dosing were also just so nice and simple. They were give this dose once or twice a day, and that's it. You don't have to adjust it for age. You don't have to adjust it for height or weight. And so everybody was put on these standardized doses. Now, when I started doing this, I went and looked at the pharmacology on these drugs, and it's like, well, you know, this thing only has a 19-hour half-life. I probably should be dosing it at half as much twice a day. And so that's basically how I've used the agents, because I want a nice, smooth level. Dabigatran, one of these drugs, was recently studied quite thoroughly in something called the RELY trial, R-E-L-Y trial. And researchers looked at plasma concentration, and they found that between individuals, there was as much as a 400 times difference in peak drug concentration. That's not so good. They also found that the drug was between 3% and 7% bioavailable. So in other words, people have different amounts that they absorb into their bloodstream. And what the researchers concluded is that we really should be checking blood levels to make sure that the dose that we're giving of these things is getting into the bloodstream at an appropriate therapeutic range. We have got the data sets now. The drug companies that make these agents, in the case of dabigatran, that's Boehringer Ingelheim, they've got 10,000 patient data sets. We could figure out what the blood levels should be. And in the light of the introduction of these drugs in the last couple of, about 5 years ago initially, I think at this point, we've now got data that show that these drugs are not superior to Coumadin in terms of hemorrhages. They're actually worse. They're more convenient. And we were sold a bit of a bill of goods that they had a broader therapeutic range. In fact, there's quite a lot of individual variability. Surprise, surprise, right? And as we go forward with these relatively new agents and learn more about them, we need to revise our management strategies. So if you're on one of these new factor 10A inhibitors, I would encourage you to talk to your doctor about getting at least once blood tested to make sure that you have the drug in a therapeutic range. Your doctor will probably have to do some homework about how to go about doing that because, quite frankly, none of the drug companies have educated anybody on this. They've marketed this as an easy, convenient option because, hey, that's how you market things. Just going to read a quick email. This is off to Julie in Chicago. Hi, Dr. Don. Wondering what you thought about doTERRA supplements, in particular their lifelong vitality vitamins. And, you know, normally I don't answer questions like this, Julie, on specific products, but I thought, you know, this gives me an opportunity to tell you what to not look for in a vitamin. And so this is a good example of what not to look for in a vitamin. These particular products have a large variety of things in doses that are not likely to do much. A whole bunch of things that you will have heard of, CoQ10, silymarin, which is milk thistle, et cetera, but in volumes, in milligram doses that are literally a tenth to a third of what I would ordinarily use therapeutically if I was trying to use these agents to actually achieve anything. So systematic underdosing is one of the features you'll see in these, you know, throw everything in their vitamins. Another thing, look at how much are you getting. And the other product, the other issue with a lot of these, they look very slick, you know, that they do everything for you. The websites are always really beautiful. Often it's a network marketing thing where you have to join up somehow and subscribe, and you get a discount if you get other people to join. These sorts of things should really raise red flags anytime you see them with respect to a product. If a nutritional product is any good, it should be able to stand alone. And when you see these suites of products, particularly the everything and the kitchen sink approach, I recommend thinking twice. And if it's mainly about the dosing, so look at the milligrams, go online, go to Google Scholar. If you want to know what the appropriate dose for milk thistle is, for example, you figure out what the active ingredient is. In this case, a quick Wikipedia search will tell you that we think it's silymarin. And then you go to Google Scholar and you put in silymarin dosage, and up will pop a lot of good science that will tell you that studies that showed that it works used 200 or 300 milligrams. Now, if that's the case, that's the dose I would want to give people to try to protect their liver, not 30 milligrams or 80 milligrams, but 300, because that's what the science shows. And that's how you have to do this if you're going to be an intelligent consumer, because just as you can be hoodwinked by the medical establishment into getting an arguably unnecessary surgery or taking a very expensive pill when a cheaper generic would work, you can also get hoodwinked by the nutraceutical industry, which is a big industry. And wherever there's money, there's going to be spin, there's going to be marketing, there's going to be gaming. And it's up to you to be an intelligent consumer. And it's up to me to try to help you learn how to do that. Going now to Tom in Carmel. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for doing what you do on the air.
You're welcome.
I'm calling about something that my doctor prescribed, Flomax for
yes.
BPH.
Uh-huh.
And the instructions say take one capsule by mouth 30 minutes after the same meal each day. And I've tried to figure out how critical that is in conjunction with meals and stuff. And what I've been able to find at the common Google responses online is that it's just about taking it the same time each day. But I'm wondering if there's any interaction with what you, with food that would require to be taken on an empty stomach or full or whatever.
Okay. So, first of all, the Flomax is tamulosin, and
mm-hmm.
it's not, there are a number of things that are known to interact with it. There are a couple of foods to avoid, and I'm actually pulling this, mainly the things that you want to worry about are grapefruit.
Okay.
And that's because grapefruit is an upregulator of one of the breakdown enzymes, so it's going to affect the way that this is processed by the body. And actually, grapefruit is one of those things that interacts with probably the greatest number of drugs that we know of in terms of foods. In general, this can be taken on an empty stomach. It does not have to be taken with food. And it is consistency is probably the biggest issue that
okay.
you want to worry about. If you,
okay.
it's basically designed to help you through the night is kind of how I look at Flomax, because the thing that bothers people the most is their having to get up in the middle of the night four or five times
right.
to pee. I mean, that's the that's the big thing. And this is a smooth muscle relaxant. So it's basically like if you had a back spasm, you'd take a muscle relaxant.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take it fasting, it'll absorb really well. And it'll hit the bloodstream pretty much at maximum concentration about 4 hours later. If you take it with food, it'll take a little bit longer, and you'll actually not absorb as much of it. So, I don't understand why they're telling you actually to take it an hour after a meal. Except, I guess they're thinking by then you'll have emptied your stomach, and so it's you'll be fasting. But the key point is if you think about it, if you eat dinner. And you take the pill an hour after dinner, and you go to bed 3 hours later, then this stuff is going to peak about, it's going to be working really well about 6 hours after you took it. If you are if you're fasting and you take it, it's going to start working about 2 hours earlier. So it'll be working 4 hours after you took it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to manage to take, if you're trying to get it to peak at night.
Yeah.
You'd have to eat dinner at like 4 in the afternoon and go to bed
Got
at 11.
So, nothing was mentioned about any of this, and I started taking it after lunch. And then one day I forgot and changed it to after dinner. And from what you're saying, it sounds like that's a better approach if I have an early dinner.
Yeah, I think if you either take it, if you're going to have a late dinner, then take it a couple of hours before dinner. Because that's that would work too. So if you're if you typically eat at 7 p.m. and you take it at 5 and you're in bed by 11, you should have drug working for, you know, through 5 in the morning. So
that's one of the things that it was confusing me, because my meals are pretty erratic because I travel and work out of town
So rule of thumb, I would say if you can take it on an empty stomach, it's going to kick in sooner. And you probably need to give it an hour before you eat anything.
Okay.
Okay?
Great. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I tried saw palmetto, before going to the doctor with this, and I didn't really experience any changes, but I don't know if I stayed with it.
Well, unfortunately, saw palmetto often takes, I've had it take up to 3 months to really kick in. The mechanism is different. Saw palmetto is a bit more like Proscar or finasteride in terms of its mechanism of action.
Okay.
It's not a smooth muscle relaxant, and so it, a different mechanism takes longer to work. I'll often put people on both and then pull people off of the Flomax after about 3 months and see how they do. And if you have a heart condition, particularly any irregular heartbeat, I really don't recommend using Flomax.
Okay. Good to know. All right. I would prefer an herbal approach. I started in college as a chemistry major and would much prefer to stay away from the synthetics.
Right. The molecules that our bodies were not evolved to handle sometimes have interesting unintended consequences.
Yeah, petrochemicals, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a little knowledge is a scary thing, isn't it?
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much for what you do.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, next email goes out to Joni and Salinas. I recently heard you speak about a urine test you give to HRT patients to determine their 4-hydroxyl levels in response to hormone replacement therapy. If I understood you correctly, the metabolization of synthetic estrogen could break the DNA, which indicates risk for cancer. I asked my doctor about this, and she had no idea what I was talking about. She'd like to understand more, and I would like to be able to thoroughly explain. As it is, I've been taking 0.25/0.5 of drosperinone estradiol for 3 months, and while I do have a maternal history of ovarian cancer, yet have tested negative on BRCA 1 and 2, I'm wondering if I can relax about my risk in taking HRT. Menopause symptoms were killing me. I'm 58, otherwise healthy, and take no other meds. Thank you for clarifying this detail. Love the program. Well, Joni, first of all, I do not recommend the use of the agent that you are taking for control of menopausal symptoms. You are taking a synthetic progestin, basically a birth control pill that's been repackaged. This is Yasmin, except it's been repackaged as a lower dose drug for menopausal symptoms. Nothing wrong with that, but the breakdown of these synthetic progesterones is equally adverse. They actually are also converted to the 4-hydroxy estrone, which is the one we're talking about. Now, if your doctor would Google steroid biosynthetic pathway image, she will find lovely images of how steroid hormones are made. It all starts out with basically cholesterol that gets turned into pregnenolone, which gets turned into progesterone, which then fans out and you can either become cortisol and aldosterone, which are the steroid hormones that control salt and stress from our adrenal glands, or it could go down the hormone pathway to the sex hormones, and it can turn into DHEA and androstenedione, and then testosterone, and then the testosterone turns into estrogen, 3 different kinds of estrogen, and then those get eventually broken down in the liver. And it is this 4-hydroxyestrone, which is capable of forming a DNA adduct. That's 2 Ds, adduct. And the adducts are either temporary or permanent. A permanent DNA adduct means that when that cell divides, there's something hanging on to the DNA that interferes with transcription. So that that DNA cannot be duplicated correctly. It creates an issue. Now, anyone with more than one relative who's had cancer, you have to worry about your DNA repair, particularly if there are different cancers in the family. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are actually DNA repair flaws. They are mutations that interfere with DNA repair, and that's why the people who have those mutations have increased risks of certain cancers. But there are many, many DNA repair mutations. Probably most of the breast cancer genes that we've identified are, in fact, DNA repair mutations, because whenever DNA is damaged, there's about 90 different genes that get turned on to try and repair the DNA. So where I'm really going with this is that I prefer bioidentical hormone replacement. I like to give the body the stuff that the body is actually designed to break down, like our previous caller said. And I always bias towards compounds that have existed for millions of years on the planet, just on general principle, because I figure that I evolved on the same planet, so it's a good bet that I could handle those. There are good strategies for bioidentical hormone replacement. I suggest that you seek information about that and maybe suggest that your doctor consider taking a seminar on it so that she has more knowledge, because I love that she said, I don't know. You know, the first step to wisdom is acknowledging your ignorance. And we are all ignorant, vastly ignorant. And we could all stand to step back and say, I don't know. I should seek to find out, rather than just ignore what we don't know and stay on the trail, the path that we know. I'm a curious-minded person, and I strongly encourage your doctor to follow up on this thread. So steroid, biosynthetic pathway, diagram or image, and study what's going on, the interconversion of those things. Now, one last thing. The Women's Health Initiative study that was done back in 2002 that got everybody scared about estrogen and breast cancer, or rather that kind of put the nail in the coffin of this extremely complex, simplified this extremely complex thing. Here's what I would say about that study. There were two arms of that study. The women who took Premarin and a synthetic progesterone called medroxyprogesterone, and women who just took Premarin. And it was the group that took the synthetic progesterone that had higher breast cancer. Let me repeat that. It wasn't the group that took estrogen alone. It was estrogen plus the progesterone that actually increased the breast cancer rates. And that, to me, says that we want to stay away from synthetic progesterones. And there is every reason biochemically to agree with that, because this one goes straight and exclusively, the synthetics go straight and exclusively down that 4-hydroxyestrone pathway. So here I have a hypothesis, I have a plausible mechanism, I have the observable data corresponding to supporting my hypothesis and my explanatory model. And based on those three factors, I exclusively use bioidentical forms of hormone replacement therapy anymore in my practice. So thanks very much for the call. We're going to move now to Mary in Santa Cruz. Hello, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You're an incredible source of information. Let's see. I just wanted to ask a general question about the minimum type of vitamins that older women should take. I'm just confused by everything. And I've added all kinds of vitamins to my own daily intake because I want to be sure that I'm getting the appropriate ones.
Well, so, there's too much biological difference. There's not a one-size-fits-all answer to your question.
Uh-huh.
But I can give you some hints about how you might figure out if what you're doing is adequate.
Okay.
And so there are a couple of things that you can measure that you sound like you are probably over 65.
Yes.
So you've got Medicare, and with appropriate coding, Medicare will cover these tests at least once.
They'll
cover the tests. So in other words, you won't get a bill from the lab for testing these things. So the things that if you don't get all of these things right now. You can go to AskDrDawn.com next week, and you can listen to the show, and you can find your question on the show, because we list every single topic. And you can go back to this topic, and you can listen to the answer again. So I'm going to go a little bit fast, and I'm not going to let you repeat everything back to me, because you can go back and get this information. All right?
Yeah.
So red blood cell magnesium and zinc will tell you about your mineral absorption. You can look at your iron levels, which are probably adequate, but they should be checked. And those are tests like serum iron and ferritin. Your doctors will know about these. Methylmalonic acid is the best test for whether you're getting enough B12, because it tells us biologically whether you're getting what your body needs. I can measure a serum B12 level, but that doesn't tell me if you're getting enough. That tells me that that you're within the range of what the population is walking around with. And B12 is super important for preventing neuropathy and dementia. So big, big issues for an aging person, for healthy aging. So you got to know that your MMA, methylmalonic acid, is all right. And that one your doctor may not know about, but she can find out about it relatively easily. I also look at a red blood cell folic acid or folate level, or a homocysteine, which again, probably a homocysteine is a better test. And since I started looking at this, I've found a whole lot of people who need a special kind of folic acid. Maybe 10% of the people I check have a mutation that interferes with their ability to utilize folic acid. And again, we're talking neuropathy and dementia. So these are important issues and things that we want to avoid. And it's a long-term, lifelong risk. So getting tested once is really all you need to find out whether you need these, you need extras of these things. You can also get an omega-3, omega-6 ratio, and this tells you whether you need to be taking more fish oil capsules or whether you're at a healthy range there. And these are all tests that can be done, regular lab tests that can be done to see whether your nutrition is adequate. Oh, and what else? Vitamin D, of course. You need to know what your vitamin D level is, and it should be in the 40s or 50s. And this is just a little bit of a segue, but it's important to understand. Some doctors, if you have a low vitamin D level, they'll give you 50,000 units or even 100,000 units of vitamin D in a pill form once a week or for a while to try to build your levels up. That's not the right way to do it. And in fact, that may be dangerous. There's evidence, and this is because vitamin D is a hormone. And doctors know this, but they forget it. If you give an overdose of a hormone, you get the same effect as if you had an underdose of the hormone. So a deficiency and a massive overdose, the body treats them the same way. You actually turn off the system with the massive overdose. And so giving vitamin D in large boluses once a week is a very non-physiological, and the data is emerging that it's actually dangerous to do it that way and not benefiting the individual. You get the blood levels up, but you do it in a way that turns off the responsiveness of the system, and that's not good. So daily vitamin D supplementation only, and I prefer using D3, but I think that's a really important fundamental thing here. In general, a multivitamin should not be a single pill that has everything in it that's small. Better multivitamins are ones that are bulkier, 3 or 4 pills, because you want the stuff to get into your bloodstream, not just get into your mouth. And I prefer for elderly individuals over 65, that's not really elderly. As I get within spitting distance of that age, it's looking less and less elderly to me. But anyway, the point is, it's harder to absorb things as you age. So using a liquid form or a powdered form of vitamins improves absorption. And so I do recommend moving away from the pill approach and moving to powders in capsules or powders that you can mix with beverages. Okay?
Well, that's an awful lot of information.
I know. That was the fast download.
I'll go ahead and listen to it.
Yeah, you're going to go back to AskDrDawn.com, and that'll go up on Friday, this coming Friday. So there's about a week's lag on the shows. But they're all up there, going back to 2004, I think. And if you haven't explored the website, I want to encourage the audience to do so. You can also, whatever download Ask Dr. Dawn is going to have in the future, you'll always be able to find it at AskDrDawn.com. And this show will continue. So some form or another, you know, we shall survive. So I just want everyone to realize that. And I thank you very much for your call and your loyal listenership to all.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Bob in Houston.
We need to replace Dr. Oz with Dr. Don.
Well, I'm not sure I want to do TV, and particularly not the commercial dynamic is very touchy. I like not having an oar in the water, so to speak, in the sense that I can put something down. I could say I don't like this, and I don't have people knocking on the door of my corporate sponsor saying, "Yeah, you know, you happen to be a paid subsidiary of Boehringer Ingelheim, and she just dissed this drug on the air, and you know, I think you should pull her sponsorship." I don't want to be in that situation.
Right.
I think Dr. Oz gets support from nutritional companies. Feels like he gets some kind of support, and I'm not quite sure what that looks like. But there's certainly an appearance of there being secondary gain in his content.
Mm-hmm.
And my job is to be above the fray on that one and give you an unvarnished opinion that's where I don't get more money or less money or more support or less support.
Okay. I have a hormonal question. Oh. I know we're getting short, so maybe I'll follow up next week or after.
Oh, go ahead. I think we can do it.
It's a threefold question. I'm trying to help my wife out. She's over 60, a little bit, has pancreatitis. She's on bioidentical hormones, bias, thyroid, progesterone, and she just started taking some cortisol. She's a night shift nurse, so she's suffering from fatigue. My question is all that capsules hard on the pancreas? And also, I was trying to inform her doctor, because we're friends too, I know her doctor, about topical, but she doesn't like topical. So I know some doctors don't like all the conversion and all the stuff with the oral hormones on the liver, and et cetera. So just in general, what's your thoughts on pancreatitis, taking a lot of hormones, and then delivery system?
All right. So I don't think the capsules are hard on the pancreas. That was the easy question. I do think that I don't understand why she has pancreatitis. She's not a drinker, right?
No, she had that ever since she was in the Philippines. So she says she thinks it was related to some toxic chemicals. Maybe she was exposed to
okay.
as a young kid.
All right. Something like that is certainly possible. She might have some scarring. I'm definitely not an expert in, you know, pancreatic disease.
And then obviously, like my doctor says, some of it's self-inflicted. She's fairly good, but, you know,
well,
fatty food.
Yeah, there's
potato chips, ice cream occasionally and stuff. So.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, well, she should probably take pancreatic enzymes with any high-fat meal because that will help her pancreas rest, and you don't want to stimulate an inflamed pancreas. So she might be someone who should go on Creon, or if she can't get Creon paid for, the cheaper, Pure Encapsulations Pancreatic Enzymes is a really excellent product.
I've already done taking high doses of like Wobenzyme systemically and
okay, good. So you're on that. Now, in something to tell her doctor about the estrogen, you could go on, she could Google Scholar and search for this, but essentially the data's in. If you use topical estrogen, you don't infect the blood clotting proteins. So as far as I'm concerned, nobody should be taking it orally, because then you're increasing your thrombophlebitis risk and your stroke risk and your heart attack risk, but you don't have the increased blood clotting if you are not using it orally. So that's, you know, it's the jury's in on that one. And I just think the doctor might have missed that information because you've still got the same FDA warning on all estrogen products. The fact that she's taking cortisol really worries me. That means that her adrenals are pretty shot, and she needs to get off of nighttime shift work, or she needs to become nocturnal and not try to flip on the weekends. Are you retired?
Yes.
So could the two of you become vampires and just kind of stay up all night and sleep during the day and make that work as a lifestyle?
Well, she kind of does that somewhat on her weekends. She'll stay up till 4 or 5 in the morning, but not the complete 12-hour shift like she works, because normally on her shift work.
But she's stressing. But yeah, I get it. But she's stressing her system too much. If she's needing ancillary cortisol, she's really pushing her health here.
Yeah, she just started on that about a month ago because that was just the last straw. You know, she's still suffering from fatigue and lack of sleep, so they figured, well, let's just try some cortisol.
Yeah, but it's just a patch, okay?
Right.
You see,
right.
You aren't getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is that her body's not handling being chronically jet-lagged. And,
right.
And you know, when you mess with the system at that level, people who are shift workers have more cancer. I mean, that's a statistical fact, and it's a big jump. It's like 30% increase. So it's a big sacrifice. And if do you really want to continue to do that? Is there any way not to do that? You have to ask the hard question, because you're burning telomeres here, and you only get so many before you're old.
Right.
See, we did get through the question. Any last follow-up there?
Topical progesterone as opposed to oral progesterone. Is that effective?
I use either or. I don't worry so much about that. The difference is if you're having trouble sleeping, oral progesterone is much better at making you sleepy. So taking that at night really helps if women postmenopausally are having trouble sleeping. And if sleep is not an issue, and then using the topical might be more convenient, because you can have it put into the same product once you get the doses figured out. You can have it put into the same product and use it topically.
And she's doing, and I think their time release too is time release.
If you take time release oral progesterone, you're not going to get the benefit of the sleep. So okay. It doesn't make you as drowsy, which maybe is good or maybe is bad, depending on the context. But in terms of its action in the body, it doesn't matter whether you use time release. Its preventative actions in the body have to do with the uterus, and it doesn't matter for that.
Okay, I'll try and present the information to her doctor kindly, and see we can follow up with at a later date then. Thank you, Dr. Don.
You're very welcome. Have a great day. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. Just blew by, and I've enjoyed it very much. I hope you have as well. Hope that you will join me. So long, and stay healthy.